Hey folks, this is Kevin. Hey, listen, before we start today, I have a very special announcement. Myself and JC Cassis, the business director of Risk, want to go on a vacation with you. You are invited to join us in Portugal this October to celebrate Risk's 15th anniversary. We have a truly extraordinary trip planned because, you know, travel is all about hearing stories and sharing stories and creating memories that become stories. But most importantly, JC and I have found that meeting Risk fans face-to-face and spending real quality time, recreational time, getting to know the folks out there in the Risk community means the world to us. So all the information is at risk-show.com/Portugal. Just fill out the form on that page and we'll reach out to you soon to let you know how to sign up. This is a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and it's going to be a total blast. So go to risk-show.com/Portugal now, and come with us to Portugal this October. Now, that said, this episode of Risk is something truly extraordinary. And because our editor and story producer, Hope Brush, put so much tender, loving care into editing this unforgettable story you're about to hear, I thought we should have the honor of having Hope host the episode as well. So now I hand things over to Hope.
Hey everyone, I'm Hope. And like Kevin said, we're going to be hearing one long story today instead of a couple short ones. So before we get into things, we're going to start off with a quick break.
We'll be right back.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Looking to start a side hustle or become your own boss? Do it with Shopify. Whether you're selling succulents or stilettos, Shopify has the industry-leading tools to help you create, control, and grow your own business. So get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.co.uk/special offer.
Now here's the show.
I'll just say, sort of off recording, if you will, even though we're recording, I'm sure, but there were many happy moments, and I never like to lose sight of that fact because that's part of what helps me today live with the tragedy that unfolded, is knowing that there were a lot of happy moments, and he had a happy childhood. So I don't know where to begin with that.
That's Tom Boulay. And this week on Risk, we're going to hear from Tom and his husband, Ken, who share their story about raising their son, Matthew, and the tragic experience that unfolded. This won't be a traditional Risk episode. We're going to do things a little bit differently this week. I'm Hope, and I'll be your host for the hour. I wanted to bring you this story specially. Last summer, I got the opportunity to meet Tom and Ken through one of my fellow Risk audio editors, John LaSala, who had heard them share their experience previously and wanted to bring it to the Risk audience. So I took a quick drive over to Sherman Oaks here in Los Angeles with the one and only David Crabb, and we sat down together in Tom and Ken's living room to hear them share their story.
The day Matthew was born, we were present in the delivery room. And it was a really exciting moment because you got to witness the birth. It was a C-section, so it was a little closeted off with a curtain. But seeing him lifted up and introduced into the world was an extremely exciting time. They conducted typical tests, and he had difficulty breathing, so they were suctioning fluid out of his lungs because of the C-section birth. He went into breathing distress, and they said he needed to go into the ICU, so they put him into the ICU. That was a devastating start to the journey, in all honesty.
That was late 1996 when Matthew was born, only a few short months after Tom and Ken began the adoption process, which they expected to take a lot longer than it did.
We decided we wanted to adopt and weren't sure how to do it, so we contacted a couple of people we knew who had done it and got the name of an attorney who did adoptions for gay parents back in 1996. It wasn't a very common thing. We met with the attorney. We had a 3-hour introductory consultation. During the middle of it, Ken shared the fact that he was HIV positive, and the attorney abruptly stopped and said, "I think we should end this meeting and you need to find another attorney. I can't help you."
And we said, "No, let's go forward. We will find someone."
That's Ken. You'll hear more from him in a minute.
So we proceeded against his advice, and we left there devastated that this was never going to happen and agreed we would never discuss it again. 1 week later, the attorney called me at my office and said, "I have a mother who wants to place a child with you." And I was completely confused by that because we weren't even expecting him to contact us again. This was October 1st, roughly, 1996. And I asked, "When is she due?" And he said, "In December." And I asked him, "In this year?" And we decided, go forward. The universe presents things to you that you don't always expect. And 8 weeks later, he was born.
I remember perfectly that moment. It was shock, you know, because after what I had divulged, when we talked to him, we had no specification as far as race, could be twins. We were very open. So the birth mother was white. The father was black. They didn't know who the father was. And he set up a phone call with the four of us. And then she flew out here.
And we put her in an apartment for a month waiting for the delivery. And he was born November 29th, 1996, with a C-section. And he had respiratory problems, so they put him into the ICU. And the next morning we went back, and they said he was improving, and they were prepared to release him. And we were excited about that, and we also let them know the ICU, I didn't know this at the time, they charged by the hour, and we didn't have insurance for him because under the law at that time, until you take the child from the hospital, your insurance wouldn't kick in. So when they heard that, they were like, "Oh, we can get him out of here quickly." And they got him out of there within the next hour or so.
That was a very large moment, getting home with him. And our friends were there. My mom was there. But it was just so amazing. We have a child. We have a newborn. We related. I mean, here we are, two gay men with a baby. It truly was fantastic. And, you know, from there, it fairly quickly turned a bit tragic.
Before we go any further, we're going to rewind the clock a little bit to when Tom and Ken first met back in 1990.
So you want to talk about meeting on Grindr?
We didn't have cell phones.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. It's pay phones and personal introductions. Anyway, I met Ken before I ever met Ken because the mutual friend who introduced us told me about him. And when I moved to San Francisco along with the mutual friend and his girlfriend, we lived about a half a mile apart and we were hanging out together a lot. And Ken was going through his separation from his ex-wife. and would come up and visit, and we met at their apartment several times. And then they did call one weekend and say, we have company, he's coming to town, can you babysit him? And I said, I'd be happy to babysit him. And so I babysat him. He stayed at my apartment for the weekend and didn't go back and visit with them again after that.
Well, and I very much remember Tom made up the sofa and put the sheets on it and everything. And then he went into the bathroom to get ready to go to sleep. And I'm like, I'm not sleeping on this sofa. And I just went and got in his bed. And he comes out of the bathroom. He's like, what? I'm like, hello.
That was the first time I learned he didn't follow the rules. I was okay with it. So I sold my car when I moved to San Francisco because there was nowhere to park it. And I bought a 2-seat Honda scooter that I used to get around. And when Ken stayed with me for the weekend, I toured him around the city on the back of the scooter. And he clung on for his sweet life and was scared to death through the whole thing. And I don't know why. I thought I was a perfectly good driver on the scooter. Yeah, it's hilly, but it's all fine. It was fun. And that ride is something Ken talks about even to this day, about how he just fell madly in love riding on the scooter.
I did. I loved everything about him. You know, I would go to his apartment. He would come home from work in a suit. I'm like, oh my God, he's so hot. And then he rides a scooter too. I was attracted to him physically, mentally, so smart, very different than who I am, but also so complimentary to each other. It just worked really, really well. And at that time, I was out gay. And Tom was, what were you, Tom?
I was gay. Was long before then, too. Just didn't know it all the time. Took a while to figure that out, but still trying to figure out whether I was going to live as a gay person in life or not. And Ken became part of the inspiration to be my full self, and proudly so.
So Tom and I meet, and I have to tell him, I think he already knew I'm HIV positive, and odds are very, very high that I'm not going to be here very long, and our relationship could be short. And I have 2 children already, and this is a big nut. I don't know why you want to take this on, but I was elated that he did. Very elated that he did. After me on the back of his scooter up and down those hills in San Francisco, I fell in love with this beautiful man. And he said he didn't care. He didn't care. And my ex-wife, she knew I was bisexual. I was young. And you realize as you get older, and here I am now, 29 years old, I'm like, no, I'm not straight and I'm not bi. I'm really gay. And I wanted to live whatever life I had left as a gay man. And I had met this amazing human being that wanted to be with me, even with all the challenges. You know, it was extraordinary. It's truly extraordinary. Through my relationship with Tom, there were 3 different episodes. One very specifically in 1994, and I was just about dead, and I actually sold a life insurance policy because I was almost dead. They said, bring the family in, and you know, it's time. He has maybe a month left. And so we bought a house. And I didn't die, which is a miracle. A new drug came out, and I went from 20 T cells to 200 T cells to back to normal, back to 800 T cells. And 2 other episodes that my system went down again, and new medication was discovered. And then back to current day, and I'm undetectable, and can't even pass it on to anybody. It's a miracle. Then there we are, sitting with the child in our living room that we had adopted.
Against all odds, nobody would have ever thought it just couldn't happen back then. And we did it.
Okay, we're back to 1996 now, just hours after Matthew was born.
We had him home with all of our friends and family, a great celebration, so much joy. And within a matter of hours, it was probably 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and he'd only been home for 3 or 4 hours by that point in time, because I think we'd gotten home around noon. He wasn't eating, and he was crying constantly, and he was starting to turn blue. We could tell he wasn't breathing properly. We called his pediatrician, and they said take him back to the hospital right away. That was a panicky moment, because everything we had laid out and everything we'd set up and all that we had gone through, and it was difficult and challenging to get through and to all of that, was falling apart in front of our eyes. So we went back to the hospital. It was very frightening, and the doctor started working on him, and several hours later came to us and said, we don't know what this is. It could be a heart condition, it could be a kidney condition, it could be a brain condition, or it could be a collapsed lung. 3 of those conditions were lifelong medicine and healthcare issues. The collapsed lung was not. We went across the street to get something to eat, cried our eyes out, because it was so devastating, and went home and waited till the morning and called and went to the hospital early, 7 or 8 in the morning. And the doctors had said that they'd finished evaluating and that it was a collapsed lung and it would take a few days for it to return to its breathing capacity. And so we were going back and forth to the hospital for several days. And on the 5th day, one of the doctors called Ken and told him Matthew was fine. And Ken asked, why are you calling to tell me this? And he said, because a nurse had dropped Matthew on the floor.
The doctor said, I'm calling to tell you everything's okay. I said, then why are you calling me? He said, well, we dropped your child on his head. I said, what? He said, a nurse was pregnant and diabetic and she passed out and dropped her child. I was stunned. I said, I'll be there as quickly as I can get there. They ran all the tests. Supposedly he was fine. One can't help but think that it has a lot to do with our story and maybe losing oxygen to the brain, quite possibly. But we made it. We made it through that period.
We marched forward from there, as we did with everything else that we've done all through the years.
I remember when he started crawling, he would crawl into his room and just sit there in the dark. And Tom asked me, he said, is that normal? I'm like, no, that's not normal. And he never really played with toys. He just wasn't really that interested in playing with toys. And we discussed that as well. And when he started walking, I would take him out on walks and he would just be screaming and he would run up to strangers' doors and start banging on it and yelling and screaming. I was horrified. I could not believe, I didn't understand. I didn't know, why is this happening? So it got to the place that I didn't even want to go out of the house with him. And Tom couldn't stay in the house with him.
Around a year, his speech was delayed, and we knew his speech was delayed. He just wasn't getting words out, and we couldn't figure out why or what the issue was. And we had gone to his pediatrician many times with a lot of ear infections, and the pediatrician suggested that we go to an ear doctor and see if he needed tubes in his ears for drainage that would then allow his hearing to be less blurred. And it was a difficult decision for me.
But because I had already raised 2 kids, you know, to 5 and 6 years old, I wasn't as nervous about doing that as Tom was.
So we did it, and his hearing did improve. The infections reduced, and he did start talking a bit. But it was slow and delayed. And so at around 2.5, we took him to a speech therapist to see whether he might benefit from speech therapy. And I met with her for about 10 minutes. I went to the appointment by myself with Matthew. Ken wasn't able to go. He flipped all the toys out of the toy chest there, didn't play with any of them, and just very randomly roamed around the room. And after 10 minutes, she said to me, "I think he may be autistic." And I was crushed, absolutely devastated by that horrible delivery and unexpected assessment from a speech therapist.
I remember.
And I came home, I drove home, and Ken was there, and I said, I told him what she had said, and I was furious at her for the way she did it. And we decided he needed the speech therapy and that I would go find a different speech therapist because I was never going to talk to her again. I couldn't deal with it. So we found another speech therapist, and at age 3, he started speech therapy. We did have behavioral issues with him as early as 2.5, and not just a typical 2-year-old tantruming. He was hitting people and kicking people and screaming a lot, almost as though he were frustrated by an inability to speak. That's part of why we went to speech therapy. And the speech therapist was trying to help him learn to stop hitting. And so she took a pillow out and put it on the floor and told him, "If you're frustrated, hit this pillow." And she would show him to do it. And he started doing that. And we would practice it at home so that he would start taking his frustration out on an inanimate object. We put him into multiple daycare facilities. We got asked to leave one after the next because of behavioral issues. The shortest one lasted 30 days at a church. And we just kept pursuing the next place, somebody who would take him. And finally, when he turned 3, we had learned about a program at LA Unified School District that they would accept preschoolers as early as age 3 in a preschool program if there were special needs. And we enrolled him in that. They accepted him into the program, and we moved forward from there.
It's 2002 now. Matthew is 6 years old.
In first grade, Matthew was in general education, which was our goal in speech therapy, and had an aide assisting him. But by October or November of his first grade year, the school was calling meetings with us. They could not control him in the classroom, and they said that they wanted to put him into a special education environment. That was a bit devastating, but we felt like if it was a good place to go and there would be help for him, we would explore it. And we did, and he enrolled in a special education program at a private school. He went into the program and spent 3 years, the rest of first grade, second, third, and into fourth grade.
And then they said, "We need to bring in the Department of Mental Health from the county." And they interviewed us here in the home and watched our home life. They watched him at school. And they told us that they score him on different levels. If it was 40 and below, they would recommend housing. And he scored a 25. But she said, "We do not recommend housing because his home life is so good that he's so calm at home and well-behaved. So we're not going to recommend housing." I was truly devastated that mental health has come in to evaluate our son. What is this, really that bad? I knew things were not quote unquote normal, but I didn't realize it was truly that horrific. There was a big period of time I stopped working so I could take care of Matthew, and I would be called in every day to come pick him up because he was causing problems. And that was for a period, and then it would be fine and he would function quite well. And it wasn't all the time, but it was a challenge.
Around the middle of fourth grade, the administrator for the school called me and said, "We can no longer keep him. He's getting out of control and we need for him to go away." And I was crushed. Once again, I was left with no options. And I asked her, "This is a special education school. I didn't think you could throw him out." And she said, "Yes, we actually can throw him out and we're going to." And I said, okay, well, then what am I supposed to do? And she said they had a sister school, and they said they would evaluate him to go into that. He did, and it was a horrible environment for him. It was a lockdown, almost like a
barbed wire all the way around.
Gates everywhere so that the students couldn't get from one place to the next. It was a very low functioning place, and he despised it and would come home and complain about it every day, and to the point
begged us to
get him out of there. And he went through fifth grade there, and Ken would sit with him every day and say, you get a behavior card. If you can improve your behavior card, we can help you get out of there. But if you can't improve your behavior card, we can't get you out of there. And sure enough, Matthew started improving his behavior card because he understood he had the keys to the car and could drive it where he wanted it to if he would follow the directions. And so he improved, and we got him into another school, another special ed school that was much higher functioning. And he kept saying, I want to go to public school. And so we just set another goal and said, if you can get the right grades, we'll look into how we can get you into another school. And he did. And at the end of sixth grade, we tried to find a private school. Somebody suggested putting him in a private school. And I remember asking this particular person, how am I going to get him into a private school when he has a file with LA Unified School District that's probably 2 feet high of meetings and papers documenting his behavior over the years? And the advice that this woman gave was just to try it, find one and try it. A day later, back to our neighborhood here, one of our neighbors who lived on the next street over owned a private school, and I'd forgotten about that. And the light bulb went off, and we knew her. She knew enough about Matthew to know what the situation was, but she wasn't so close to it day to day. And she said, come on in and we'll have a meeting and discuss it. And they said, we will enroll him for summer school. And if he does well, he can stay for seventh grade. And Matthew wanted to get out of the special ed school, so he did great that summer. The teacher adored him, and we enrolled him in private school for seventh grade. And that was a huge
and it
happy success, and it worked.
We're going to move forward a little bit now to when Matthew finishes up high school and starts college, which was in the fall of 2015. More about it now from Ken.
So we got through high school at a private boys' school without any altercations. And we decided to go to a private Catholic school in Spokane. One of the reasons is Tom's brother and sister-in-law live there. So we got him moved in, and overall, it went pretty well. As we progressed into sophomore year, he started escalating. And he would call us in the night, and he would be in the middle of a field, screaming at the top of his lungs, just angry at everybody and everything. And his anger just started getting worse. And when he would come home for break, it had started to become miserable. He was so angry at everybody. And we were no longer Dad and Papa. We were Tom and Ken. He absolutely adored the current president at that time. Mm-hmm. He came home and he said, well, I joined the Young Republicans Club. I'm like, oh, okay, good. I was so pleased he actually joined a club.
It was a huge victory. And I remember expressing so much joy because it's good. Now he's going to have to interact with other people. He stayed in the club, and then he got an internship working for a U.S. congressional candidate, doing an internship for her campaign up in Spokane, and he stayed and lived with my brother and sister-in-law and his cousin. By the end of the summer, though, he was so angry with the people he was working with. He was always calling and complaining about everything that everybody did. They weren't following the rules properly. They would show up late. They were doing what 19-year-olds did at the time. You know, you're just not all that restricted. And he needed the structure mentally, and it would frustrate him that other people were not abiding by
following the rules.
And we had let him drive his car up to Washington for the summer because he needed it for the internship. He drove up there by himself. He was determined to do it. But I asked him, do you want me to drive you home, or are you going to drive home by yourself? He said, I want you to fly up and drive back with me. The first 2 to 3 hours of that ride home were some of the worst hours of the 20 years up to that point, because he did nothing but vomit out anger and frustration with all the different people in the internship with him. And honestly, to this day, I can't tell you what everything was that he said, because I tuned it out. I just stopped listening, really, and trying to rationalize with him. I just let him go and go and go. And it lasted for several hours until he finally stopped.
Now it's the summer after Matthew's sophomore year of college. He's back home in LA living with his parents during the school break.
He was working at a theater, and we were at the Hollywood Bowl, and I get a phone call, and he was screaming and yelling and had lost it. And I could barely hear, and I handed the phone to Tom.
So I took the call and I walked out of the bowl and listened to what he had to say. Many times when he would call in a rage, I would just let him go on and on, because I wasn't trying to interrupt. I wasn't trying to correct. I just wanted to hear what he had to say. I think one of the customers had basically accused him of rifling through her bag as they were doing security checks and made some sort of racist remark, and it sent him over the edge. His shift had ended and he was ready to leave. So I told him just to go home and we would talk about it. He could talk about it more when we got home. By the time we got home from the Hollywood Bowl, we walked into the kitchen and we saw stab marks in the kitchen cabinets, and all of his high school tennis medals and his black belt from Taekwondo and all of the belts that he earned from Taekwondo. He'd put them on the breakfast area table, and we asked him what had happened, and he said he destroyed the cabinets and put all of his awards in the kitchen because he didn't deserve them. He wasn't worthy of them anymore for having destroyed this property and gone into a rage. And that broke my heart, because I didn't want to see him beating himself up for his emotion, even though he knew what he did was wrong, and I appreciated that. He always knew right from wrong. We just said, you know, these are your awards. You earned them. It's okay. And what you've done here is not okay. Prior to that evening, he had really not destroyed many other things. He had punched holes in the wall in his bathroom once or twice. And we decided not to repair those holes because we wanted him to see the evidence of his action and not just be there to fix things and pick up pieces for him. So we left the holes in the wall, and I figured he might just punch another hole in the wall anyway if we did fix it. So we just left it there for a year or two. He went back away for junior year. We were happy with that again, because it was really difficult living with him at times because of his frustration and anger. It was tense. And he came back junior year and actually got a job again at the same theater, which I thought he must not have been all that bad to employ if they hired him back. And that's a good thing. But I could also tell what I sensed was a sense of anxiety on his part that I associated with possibly his being scared to go back for senior year and finish college, because that was going to be a turning point where he was going to have to figure out what to do with himself in the world in some respects. Not that we were going to stop being a support system for him, but I think it was daunting to him, and I think he was afraid, and I think he had a lot of anxiety about it.
He was angry. He was angry about everything. He stayed in his room most of the time. He just gamed and went to work, and he was not the same. He was different. And one night he came into our bedroom in the middle of the night.
More on that in a minute. But first, we're going to take a really quick break. Don't go anywhere.
We'll be right back.
I'm Tank Sinatra.
And I'm Investigator Slater.
And together we co-host a podcast called Psychopedia, which is a true crime podcast infused with comedy, making it a crimedy. Each week, Investigator Slater brings us a wild and thoroughly researched true crime case. I'm here to digest it all and react just like you probably are right there on the other side of the microphone.
Somehow, I've got to present each case with the detail and respect it deserves, while also cracking up at Tank's perfectly timed humor and thought-provoking questions.
Listen to and follow Psychopedia on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back.
Welcome back. Just for a quick recap, It's 2018, and Matthew's back home after his junior year of college. It's late one night, and Tom and Ken are asleep.
He had never come in our room in the middle of the night, ever. And he came in the room around 1 in the morning and stood over the bed on Ken's side and just started screaming and ranting. And I didn't know what he was screaming or ranting about. I couldn't tell you to this day because it woke me up with such surprise. And I didn't know what was going on. I wasn't sure what was happening. And he stood there for probably 15 seconds or longer doing that. And then he stopped and turned around and walked out and went back to his room and shut the door. And I thought, this is really strange, out of character, new, worse than anything ever.
And I slept through the whole thing.
And Ken did sleep through the whole thing.
Never heard anything.
I decided not to go back to talk to him at that moment because I thought, he's agitated and I don't want to further exasperate that. So I will leave it and just talk to him in the morning. And I went back to sleep. The next morning I got up around 8 a.m. I went into his room. He was awake at his desk and there were feathers all over the floor. And I remember looking at the feathers and thinking, what is this? And I asked him, what did you do? And he said, when I was a child, you told me to hit a pillow when I was frustrated. And I said, what the speech therapist told you to do was to hit a pillow, not destroy a pillow. And you've destroyed a pillow here, and don't do that again. I said, get the vacuum, clean it up, and don't ever come in our room in the middle of the night and do what you did again, because I'm not going to live here in fear, and we're not going to live this way. So you've crossed a line, and if you do it again, we're going to send you back to Washington State, where you have an apartment and school starts in another month and a half, and you can just wait for school to start, but you're going to go up there, and I'm not going to live like this in our house. He said, okay, and I left the room, and he cleaned it up, and onward we went for another month until July 24th. At around 1 in the morning, he came into the room and started screaming and raging over us in the bed on Ken's side again. I woke up again and saw that he was doing this, and he again stopped after 15, 30 seconds and went back to his room and shut the door. And I was angry, and I got up and decided, I am going to address this now, because I'd drawn the line a month earlier. All through his childhood, he was responsive to boundaries. If you just made them clear for him, he would follow them. He was a rule follower. And so I decided to go back and tell him, you've crossed the line. We've discussed this. We have a place for you to go, and we're going to send you there tomorrow. We'll talk about it in the morning. Went back to his room. The door was locked. I could hear him rustling around in there. It was noisy. I didn't know what he was doing. And I knocked on the door and told him, unlock the door, unlock the door. I want to talk to you. And he unlocked the door, and I went in and said, we're going to talk tomorrow morning about your going back to Washington State for the remainder of the summer until school begins. And then I went into his bathroom to check to see if he'd punched holes in the wall. And he had punched a hole in the wall again. And I turned around to go back to my own room. And he had followed me into the bathroom, and I was standing 2 feet away from him. And he had a look of rage in his eyes, one that was not unusual to see. So I looked at him in the eye and said, I'm going back to bed now, and we can talk in the morning. I started to walk out of the bathroom. I walked past him. And when I walked past him, I felt him turn around, and I felt him grab my neck with his forearm, and he put me in a headlock and hit me. And I thought, wow, he's never punched me before. I can't believe he's doing this. And then he pushed me forward toward the bedroom, and there were several steps getting to the bedroom, but I could feel him forcing me. And keep in mind, he's a black belt in Taekwondo. He's 21 years old and in better shape than I am. I wasn't really in a place, and I was half asleep, and I wasn't really in a place to, I didn't want to get into a physical altercation to fight back. He could take me down in a heartbeat. So I went along, and I felt him hit me again. And then I felt him hit me a third time, and I saw blood fly out from my robe. And I remember thinking, wow, he must have hit me really hard, because I think that was blood that just flew out of my robe. And it was a very dark robe, and it was dark in the room, and I couldn't really see all that well, but I could see blood flying across the room, and I didn't understand what was going on. And at that point, I could hear him whispering what sounded like a playbook to me of a rehearsed recital of what to do to inflict the wounds that he was inflicting.
And now cut the ear, slash the colon, and now cut the neck, stab the abdomen.
But I was in a state of shock and standing in a slumber. I had tried to wake Ken up when I'd gone into his room, but he was sound asleep.
For some reason, I just woke up and I'm like, oh, Tom's not here. So I put on my shorts and I see the light on in Matthew's bedroom, and I walk back there, and Matthew had Tom in a headlock with his forearm, and the knife with his right hand was up in the air, and I was in utter shock. I had no idea that Tom had already been stabbed because he had a black robe on. I couldn't see anything, and I had just woken up. And I immediately went to grab the knife with my left hand, and he dropped Tom, and he started to go after me. And I looked at Tom, and I said, Tom, he's trying to kill us. He's trying to kill us. And Tom jolted, I recall.
It did jolt me out of my shock, and I remember thinking, I have to do something here. And I remember seeing Ken leave the room and thinking, if he's trying to kill us, why is he leaving me? Not knowing what had gone on, because it all happened behind my back. And yet Matthew had left me. And I grabbed my phone, and I called 911 after I unlocked it. And I was bleeding all over the keyboard, and I remember dropping the phone and thinking, oh shit, you know, the keyboard's not gonna work. And I lost the connection, and then I called again, and it went through. And I said to the operator when he answered, my name is Tom Boulay, and I'm at this address, and I need the police to get me out of here. And he said, we know who you are, and we know where you are. This is the third call we've had from your residence this evening. I remember thinking, who would have called? Because Ken sleeps with his phone in the living room. I hadn't called anyone, and there was nobody else in the house except for Matthew, and it never entered my mind that Matthew had called. I didn't learn that until later. As I'm on the phone with the operator with 911, one of our two dogs came in and was licking up the blood, and Matthew came back in the room. And I said, get the dog out of here, only to trying to distract Matthew. And so he took the dog and put the dog in the backyard. Like, why he would listen at that time, I have no idea, but nothing rational was happening. And then he came back in the bedroom and he kicked me a couple of times on the side. And I was on the floor in a fetal position holding the phone, and I was turned toward the closet in the room, and he turned around and slashed my neck, and that was the last stab. And I remember him turning around and saying, now I can tell Dwayne I finished the job. I didn't know what on earth was going on in his head. I just knew I had to get out of there. And he left the room.
I remember running out of the room. I was trying to hold on to the walls and trying to breathe, and blood was coming out of me with every breath. And at that point, I didn't actually know I had been stabbed all over my arm. I was in shock, and I made it into our living room, and I went down on the floor. And I remember him standing over me with the phone underneath his mouth, talking to somebody. And he said, AIDSzilla is bleeding out. And I thought, okay, act like you're dead. And he walked away. And in my mind, I'm like, okay, I can't help Tom anymore. And so you must get up and open that door, because I could hear the police. The helicopters were swarming. I could see lights through the curtains. I don't know how, but I stood up And I opened the door, covered in blood. There must have been 20 cops. I saw two ambulances, and the cop said, run across the street. And I only knew I got across the street because I saw it in the footage. I didn't know there was a film crew across the street. I didn't know all of our neighbors were standing across the street. And I passed out.
I remember hearing the police come in, and I heard them call Matthew's name. They said, Matthew Boulay. And I remember thinking, how do they know who he is? Not knowing that he had called at that point in time. And I heard Matthew walk past our bedroom and through the hallway and said, this is Matthew, which was him surrendering, basically. And after that, I remember two people or more coming into the bedroom and grabbing me and putting blankets around me to get me to stop bleeding and going down the stairs on a gurney. And I remember them turning the lights on in the ambulance as we were driving to the hospital and screaming at me basically to stay conscious. And then I remember nothing, just darkness, and I went into surgery. I recall dying three times during surgery. Everybody talks about the white light, and I remember feeling suctioned out of my body, like, I don't know how else to describe it, but in the very old days, you could go to the bank and put your bank deposit into a little chute and it would vacuum up into the other side. It felt like going through that type of machine. And on the other side, there was little conference rooms with a table in each one. And I was in one of them on the top floor with somebody who I wasn't sure who it was. And I got sent back. And then I went back a second time, and then I went a third time and third consultation and came back. And I woke up in the ICU. I didn't know what had happened, what all my injuries were. I didn't know anything that had happened. I just knew I was in really bad shape. And I remember thinking at that moment, I forgive him for what he did, and I need to recover and get myself better. And the only way I'm going to do that is not to hold animosity, negativity, or anger, but instead to focus on health, well-being, care, and love. It wasn't for days that I learned, you know, I'd been stabbed 21 times and had 6 pints of blood infused into me, and all the things that had happened in my ears were almost cut off and they were stapled onto my head. And I had stab wounds in my abdomen, and my colon had been severed, and my brachial plexus nerve that I didn't even know existed had been severed, and I couldn't lift my arm. And many other things. There were stab wounds in the back of my skull and in the back of my neck, at the top of my spine.
You were stabbed 21 times.
Yes.
And I had passed out, and I woke up, and I asked, where am I? And they said, you're at UCLA. And I said, where's Tom? They said, he's in emergency surgery and they're trying to save his life. There's got to be someone we can call so they can notify people of what happened. And so I told him a friend of ours, and they found the number. And next thing I knew, she was there. And I guess, I don't remember this, but I guess I was like, wow, that doctor's so hot, Dana. You should flirt with him. He's so hot. As he's sewing me up and shoving a tube down my back because my lung was collapsed, she goes, you were just cracking jokes and talking about how hot the doctor was and that you two should go out with each other. I have no idea why I was in that state. Tom had to get 6 pints of blood, and I had to get 1 pint of blood, and 3 surgeries on my arm and 1 surgery on my hand. And we didn't see each other. They tried to figure out how can they get my bed up to where Tom was so I could see him, but it just never came to fruition. And
for 6 days.
Was it 6 days?
6 days.
So they brought Tom down to my floor, and I don't think there was a plan for us to meet, but I was out walking, pulling, you know, the IV, and there he was, and the joy of just seeing him, that he was alive, was just overwhelming. It was completely overwhelming. And his boss was there, who I'd never even met.
And we both burst into tears, Ken and me. And literally in tears. And she looked at me and she said, "I think I'll leave you two alone for a minute," and walked out of the room. And I thought, thank God. So it was very emotional to actually see each other. I'd been in ICU for 6 days. And when I finally got out of ICU, I got moved onto the same floor as Ken. I remember when we saw each other, just bawling, asking, "What happened? What happened? How could this have happened?" And such loss of ability to explain or know.
Comprehend.
Or comprehend it was baffling.
It truly was a place for me mentally of, why would he hurt us? Why would he do such a thing? We never hurt him. We never abused him. We did everything to help him. But I think it comes back again to something that I've always thought about this, is that he blamed us for how he was and what was going on in his mind mentally.
I felt very helpless because I felt like there was nothing I could do for him at that point. I've done everything I know how to do, and it's not enough, and I don't know what else to do next, and I don't know what's going to happen either. I mean, I had no idea what the process would be or what was going to unfold. On the brighter side, we had lots of visitors. Our neighbors gathered together the Friday after this happened, and about 70 people showed up at one of the neighbors' house to talk about what they could do for us, and they put an entire list together of who could do what days of the week, what times. They did a 10-minute video tribute to us where they all gave testimonials of their connection with us. I couldn't watch it for more than a month after I got home. I didn't watch it. I couldn't. And they signed us up for Meal Train, and people were bringing meals for over 2 months every single day, dropping in, visiting. I joke with people that I got to go to my own funeral. There were a lot of flowers, cards, and nice things being said. Ken's mother stayed with us and helped us. We could not have done on our own for that period of time.
Oh, no.
There was no way. And so many people were so helpful that it was just incredible. Work told me, come back on your own terms, on your own time, no restrictions whatsoever, and which was a huge support as well. So those were some of the happier sides of it, if you want to call it happier sides. There was a lot of redemption in your faith in humanity through all of that.
Without a doubt.
There was a therapist that we saw for a year after this all happened who was a great help as well. We would go every Friday at 5 o'clock and have a session, and then right below was a neighborhood bar and restaurant. We'd go have happy hour and just move back on with life. So that was date night for a year.
And the first two sessions, she literally walked to our house and sat in the backyard. And that, in the beginning, was just with me. You were still in the hospital. And it was our neighbor and close friend, who is a therapist, that said, I think she would be the perfect person for you. And she was. She was a lifesaver.
Yes.
Just to get us back on track.
I share one pearl of wisdom to this day with a lot of people, and that is that she gave me a model to say you have a victim hat and you have a parent hat, and those two have conflicting sentiments and emotions. And what I've learned to do is to live with all of it, and I'm okay with it. I don't need them to reconcile or one to win over the other. I have them both. 99% of the time, I just have Tom today right here doing this. But when the 1% of the time comes along that I feel victim sentiments, I process and go. And when the parent sentiments come along, I process and go. And it's just, I know it's all there. It's all okay.
We're now in the spring of 2019, almost a year after the stabbing.
When it came to the pretrial hearing, I had decided already in my own mind that I wasn't a resource to help him, and that I really wanted to cooperate with the district attorney to just offer the testimony, and Matthew had to live the consequence of what he had done. And I didn't want to be in front of that, and I needed my own time and space to heal. So I let the DA do what the DA did. It is the people of Los Angeles against Matthew. It's not Tom and Ken, Dad and Papa. It was extremely hard to go to the hearing knowing we were going to see him for the first time, shackled, not knowing what he was going to look like. A little bit of fear of seeing him. So in addition to having to testify with him sitting in the room and in front of other people and tell this story, it was seeing him that was really difficult. We'd not heard from him. There was no contact allowed, as far as I know, and I didn't try to reach out to him. I was not in a place to do that. And that was difficult, seeing him walk in shackles, very thin, with a beard, hair all grown out, and heartbreaking. Just heartbreaking.
It was surreal, to say the least. And getting up on the stand, I was nervous, but I said what I needed to say. I said exactly what Matthew said to me as I was laying on the floor. And the defense stood up and then brought up the issue of being HIV positive. And the judge was furious. And so was the prosecutor, and shut him down immediately. And it was expunged from everything. Because it made no... What was the purpose of that? There was no purpose.
The police discovered Dwayne through Matthew's gaming machines. And so they told us to not dispose of anything that was his. And they did find Dwayne. And Dwayne was a young adult, around 18 years old, I think, in another state that Matthew was gaming with, who had, he'd made statements to, "I'm going to kill my parents." And Dwayne did not take that seriously. He thought Matthew was just, I don't know, going off, and ignored it. And so no charges were ever brought against Dwayne. He was never a threat. I don't even know who he is. I don't know his last name. There are probably quite a few things I still don't know. I don't know what the content of the 911 call was that Matthew made, other than the fact that he told the police he was going to kill us. So, you know, we never got those details, and I tried to stay out of it. In some ways, I don't know that I wanted to get closer to it than I already was.
And so interesting that he called 911. So there's a part in his mind that he wanted to be apprehended. Or why else would he call 911? You know, we would be dead.
In many ways, he saved our lives by calling 911. How ironic is that?
It's very ironic.
Matthew was charged with 2 counts of premeditated murder and 2 counts of gross bodily harm. The premeditation carries the potential for a life sentence. After the pretrial hearing, the courts determined there was enough evidence to hold him until a trial. And COVID came along in early 2020, and that delayed everything. So he was held in county prison for a very long time. And a trial was finally set to take place late in 2021 or early 2022. In late 2021, the district attorney contacted us and said he wanted to accept a plea bargain to plead guilty of attempted murder, not premeditated, and gross bodily harm, and that the sentence would be about 15 years for all the counts. His recommendation was to accept that bargain from the public defender because he felt like Matthew, who had no past history or record of any criminality, would not be getting a life sentence under any circumstance, and that the charges would carry about the same sentence as if we were to accept the plea, and we wouldn't have to go through the trial. We didn't want to go through the trial because it's extremely stressful and difficult to be in that situation. And here we are as a gay couple with our black child and facing a group of our peers, a jury of 12 people that we know for a fact, having been jurors ourselves, bring their own baggage into the process. And we didn't want whatever their baggage may be, despite all the vetting, to end up in a result where he was found not guilty and released. That was a big risk from our standpoint, and we did not want that to happen. We don't feel safe with the idea of him being around and loose. So at the DA's recommendation, we accepted the plea bargain, and he was sentenced to about 15 years in prison. Time previously spent was not counted toward his sentence, so the clock started again at that time for about 15 years, but it can be reduced in California to 85% if he's on good behavior. So around 13 years, which would put it out to 2033. And we'll see what happens there. We've had a lot of people ask us from the very beginning, what are you going to do when Matthew gets out of prison? And my response to them is, if I'm still alive at that point in time, I'll think about it then. I'm not going to think about it today and spend 15 years wondering what I'm supposed to do in the future. And that ends the conversation.
And I think about it from time to time, what I personally would do. Do we put a wall around our house? Do we get extra security? Do we move? Some ways I feel the same as Tom. I'll deal with that emotion when that happens. But what I do know is I would never be alone with him ever again. I don't want a relationship with him. I don't think I could quite handle that. Tom was very quick to forgive. I don't dwell on it, but I don't know that I've gotten to that place of complete forgiveness. But that being said, I don't sit here and hold animosity or anger. I'm not angered. I'm sad for him that he has to spend his life in a mental ward of the prison because of his behavior. The son we have raised for 21 years, and in my estimation, have done a damn good job. For whatever reason, he decided he wanted us dead. And now he's in prison in a mental ward. And what's going to happen when he gets out? Every time I go under an underpass and see all the homeless, I'm like, well, that's where he'll be.
Along with the plea bargain, the district attorney recommended we get a protective order that would prevent any communication by him or by us to one another for a 10-year period of time. I hesitated at the time to agree to it because I wasn't sure how I'd feel in 10 years and I knew he was going to be in prison the whole time, but I agreed to it and Ken agreed to it. Around November of 2021, Matthew called. He was able to get through on a phone at the prison. I was at a breakfast and didn't have my phone on and didn't get the call, and he called Ken as well. And Ken did get the call.
I see this call coming in from Houston, you know, like any call that you don't know who it is. So I didn't answer, listened to the voicemail, and it was the prison system with the call from Matthew. And if I would accept the charges, and I was panicked. And he called back, and I answered it. It was weird, and in a way, I was afraid if I didn't answer it, what is he going to do? I know that sounds strange, but that's kind of what I was thinking. And he apologized profusely. He seemed in his right mind. I believe he asked about the dogs. He apologized for ruining our house. I was so stunned, and I didn't know what to say to him at all. And he called Tom at another date, and Tom did talk to him.
He called me the day after he called Ken, and I knew that when I saw the 713 area code phone number that it was the prison system, and I answered the call, and I accepted the charges, and I spoke with him briefly. He only has about 10 minutes of phone time per day. The first conversation was very limited, just as Ken's was. I didn't know what to say, and I hadn't wanted to talk to him previously because my mindset when I first got out of the hospital was, I don't know what to say to somebody who thinks I should have been dead. There's nothing left to talk about. That took me over a year to get past, but when he finally called, I was actually happy to hear from him. I wanted to know, the parrot hat, I wanted to know, was he okay? What are his circumstances? And not that I could do anything to really improve them or change them. I also wanted him to know, I still support him and care about him and love him. The first conversation was very brief and awkward. We talked about what his day was like and not much more. After I hung up, it gave me an opportunity to think about what did I really want to know about. And when he called me again the next day, I had questions prepared. How was the food? Was he in a cell by himself or did he have a cellmate? How was the cellmate? Was he doing okay with the cellmate or was he not doing okay with the cellmate? Was he getting mental health services in the prison? I felt better having that contact. And I allowed him to continue to call despite the protective order that said he couldn't. And I didn't turn him in for that. I didn't want to turn him in. Over the course of time, he did apologize. His apologies were half apologies at first, sort of blaming us and him. Later, he much more fully apologized, and he started writing letters shortly after that. And those letters were very helpful for me as well. A lot of apologies. A couple of them were very random, and I still don't know that I can understand them. His mental state was probably not very stable when he wrote those. But nothing threatening, nothing bad. And it's been helpful for me. It's been cathartic to kind of reestablish connection. And I've felt better being able to tell him on phone calls in response to his letters that say things like, I was a bad kid and you probably don't like me. I was able to tell him, you are a good person. You did a wrong thing and you know that. But you are not a bad person. You are not flawed. You have mental health issues and you have to address those, but you're not a bad person. Don't think negatively about yourself despite what you did.
And I was unable to do that. And I took one more phone call from him and I couldn't do it anymore. I could not do it. I did not want to have any conversations with him whatsoever. It was just way too difficult emotionally. It was like bringing it all up again. Every time he called and every letter he wrote.
I decided to have the protective order modified for myself so that I could communicate with him and possibly even visit at some point if I wanted to. I went to the court and asked to have a hearing to revise the protective order. He got brought back to Los Angeles. He had been in state prison down near San Diego. We got to the court date in early 2023, and I saw him there. We lifted or revised the protective order so we could communicate with one another, and I have not heard from him since. I think he had a complete mental break and am not sure of anything other than the fact that he's in a mental health facility in the prison system in Northern California. I've sent him two notes. I haven't heard back, and that's the current state of communication. I'm waiting to hear and figure out what's next.
I think that there's the first time in 21 years our house has been calm. And there's not all this anger and stress. And now that he's been gone since 2018, you know, our life is calmer. Sometimes I miss him, but to be honest, not very often. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Was raise him. It was really, really difficult. And I do love him, but I don't like him very much. After what happened, and sometimes it hits me and it goes through my head, and every once in a while I'll have a dream that he's in it, and it's typically not good. And we did have good times, but the last 10 years were so difficult, and then the way it ended, to me, it's final.
When Matthew was born and he had to go back to the hospital, and we went to visit him on his second day here on Earth, I remember walking down the hallway of the hospital toward the ICU and thinking, I don't even know if I'm going to recognize which child it is in this room. How am I going to know? What if I get the wrong child and pick the wrong one? And I walked in the door and I scanned around the room and I saw him from across the room and I burst into tears because I was like, how could I have possibly thought I wouldn't know who he was? He is my son. And I carry that to this day, despite what happened 5 years ago. I see him as our son who did something very wrong. And I have hope for him as I've always had hope for him. As a parent, the goal is to have your child be as productive and successful as possible with whatever they got in the world, in life. And I still hope that for him, that when he gets out of prison, that he is able to do something in some capacity to experience some sort of joy in the world. I carry that hope. And if I am able to reestablish contact, I will offer some support. we're still in the house that we lived in when this all happened. And when it all happened, many friends came by and said, are you going to move? Are you going to leave here? And both of us were very quick to say, no, we love it here. We love our house. We love our friends that are here. We love our neighbors. And it was difficult being here with Matthew, but Matthew was gone. And I have never had PTSD issues walking right back into the room where the stabbing took place. I don't dwell upon it. So I don't need to leave here, and I'm not going to have somebody else do something to me that makes me want to leave. So I'm happy, and I'm staying where I'm happy.
Because of what happened, it was not going to force me personally out of our home, where we live in an amazing environment, just as Tom said, with friends and family, and it's bliss. It's paradise.
That was Tom Boulay and Ken Call, sharing their story so candidly for us all to reflect on. I'm so grateful to them for opening up their home to David Crabb and I during the recording of the story, and for being truly brave and honest in the hopes that sharing it might help someone who hears it. After almost 6 years, this is only the second time that Tom and Ken have shared their story publicly. The first was on the podcast All the Wiser, which is hosted by Kimmy Culp and edited by our very own John LaSala. You can check out the original version of this story, which features Tom and Ken individually telling their stories in two separate episodes, at allthewiserpodcast.com/episodes. Thank you again to John for first introducing us to Tom and Ken, and for playing a big behind-the-scenes role in the production of this story. I also have to say a big thank you to David Crabb again for coaching Tom and Ken during the telling of their story. He also played a huge part in how the story turned out. If you want to hear more from Tom and Ken, you can find them on Instagram at tombooollaynla and coll_Ken. They're also in the process of writing a book about all their life experiences, which I personally cannot wait for. We'll make sure to let you know when that's out in the world.
We'll be right back. We're back.
As a story producer and editor, the reason that I love working with Risk is because we all have the opportunity to pursue the creative projects that speak to us and bring them to your ears in whatever way we think suits each story best. Producing longer stories like this really is a team effort, and sometimes it stretches the bandwidth of what a small team can accomplish. When we hear stories like this, though, we know it's something that we have to do. Risk is all about telling stories that challenge you, and bringing those stories to listeners whose perspectives might be challenged just as equally. If you believe in this kind of thing as much as we do, please consider supporting the podcast on patreon.com/risk. That's all for this week, but keep the conversation going over on our Facebook page or on our Reddit sub. I'm really looking forward to hearing what you all think about this one. And I know you missed Kevin this week. So did I. So in the meantime, here's a little piece of him that will hopefully tide you over until next week.
Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.